From the Moan Broadcast Center at KPCC, this is The Frame. I'm John Horn. On today's show, what the cancellation of Marvel shows on Netflix might mean for the future of the TV business. Then from anti-war demonstrations to Arnold Schwarzenegger riding horseback, Annie Leibovitz has photographed it all. We walk through a new exhibit of her early work.
I was not a good photojournalist, so I was going to have to tell more of my story from my point of view and left journalism behind and eventually turned to portraiture because it was a way of having real license to do what you wanted in a photograph.
And the country swing band Asleep at the Wheel is still rolling along 50 years after its founding. All that coming up on The Frame. With so many new players jumping into the streaming game, including Disney, Apple, and Warner Media, 2019 is likely to bring some big changes to the TV business. We called up Daniel Feinberg, a TV critic for The Hollywood Reporter, to talk about what the future could look like to TV viewers. He's just finished covering 2 weeks of presentations from broadcast networks, cable channels, and streaming services at the Television Critics Association meetings. We started with the news from earlier this week that Netflix is canceling Jessica Jones and The Punisher, two Marvel shows which, not coincidentally, are also Disney properties.
There is no question that we are on the brink of some sort of key transition point. And regardless of what you choose to call it, whether you want to call it the streaming wars or the road to new cable or whatever you want to describe it as, there are things that are changing that are going to dramatically reshape what the media landscape looks in 5 years, in the same way that 5 years ago it looked completely different. And I think that there's no question that the cancellation of the Marvel shows on Netflix is a sign, a gesture in a certain direction, because these were very high-profile shows for Netflix when they premiered, and they were part of a big programming strategy, and now suddenly all of the Marvel properties are released part of a Disney Plus or a Disney Marvel streaming strategy, and so they don't fit with Netflix anymore. And I think that you're going to see something with the tug of war over something like Friends. I think that we are only at the beginning of what is going to be probably the biggest story in where television is going in the next year and a half, probably.
And that is basically that the people who create those shows used to see companies like Netflix as a source of ancillary revenue. And now they see streaming services as direct competitors, so they're trying to pull their content back as they're launching their own streaming services. Is that the bigger picture here?
I think that is definitely the bigger picture. And all of the things that the Netflixes and Hulus have kind of taken for granted as the foundation of their business model, you know, for whatever we want to say about the apparently $12 billion that Netflix last year poured into original programming, acquired content is still a major portion of what people actually stream on Netflix, whether it's Friends, whether it's The Office, whether it's all of the CW shows. And that's great for Netflix because it allows Netflix to have that kind of foundation, but it's also a business that the people who actually own those programs want to be in. And so is Netflix original programming, is it enough if suddenly the studios start taking away all of their prestige programs? Yeah, I don't know.
Well, let's talk about a couple of new programs, one that's on Netflix called Russian Doll and one on Hulu called Pen 15. These are shows that seem to be getting a lot of attention. Are they worth checking out, and how are they doing so far?
I think they're absolutely worth checking out, and I think we have absolutely no idea how either one of them is doing. Netflix has not put out a press release boasting that 40 million people in some form or another have watched Russian Doll, so I don't know. All I know is that it's a really good show. It's a really smart show. It's a show that plays around with format and with tone and with style in very impressive ways. So Russian Doll is definitely worth checking out. And I think Pen 15 on Hulu is a lot of fun. The gimmick is the two co-creators are basically playing junior high versions of themselves.
I heard that Connie M grew double D's her last night at camp.
That's so effed up.
How is that even possible?
I don't know. It like happened in the middle of her sleep.
That's so unfair that happens to people. I wish that was me.
They're surrounded by actual preteen and teen actors, and it's a really good show about the awkwardness of being a teenager that's maybe aimed at older viewers who survived those years.
I want to talk about a couple other shows that might be worth talking about. Fox has a series called Proven Innocent. Pop has a series called Flack, and DC Universe has a series called Doom Patrol. Are any of those shows or other things that you've seen jumping out in terms of mid-season or early start shows that are coming out either now or very soon?
One of the shows that if you've watched any ABC in the past couple weeks, and you're going to see as we move towards the Oscars this weekend, that is getting a lot of buzz for ABC is Whiskey Cavalier.
Whiskey Cavalier. You're one of our best agents. Your high intelligence. He's proven to be a huge asset to the Bureau. You and your fiancée recently parted ways?
Yes, we did. It was mutual. Mostly from her side, but I'm totally fine with it.
We have the footage.
It's a show that I would say succeeds at its goals, and that's something that I wouldn't necessarily say about, say, Proven Innocent, which is a very, very run-of-the-mill, entirely forgettable legal procedural. At the very least, Whiskey Cavalier is full of pretty people. Scott Foley and Lauren Cohan, who are the stars, are attractive and fun, and they're having a good time. It was shot in Europe, and it makes actual good use of European locations. It's got all of the depth of a very, very shallow puddle, but on the other hand, it's fun. And it's the same with DC Universe's Doom Patrol, which is kind of quirky, kind of odd, and a vast improvement over DC Universe's first live-action show, which was Titans, which was all gloomy and glum and unpleasant. So there's something to be said for improvement.
One of the other things that happens at the TCAs is that critics get sneak peeks. Maybe it's some footage, maybe it's a pilot of a show that's not going to be on for a couple of months. Is there anything that you and your colleagues saw that might not be coming out immediately, but that you're really interested in seeing what more there is to the series?
Well, I definitely can't review the one episode I've seen of FX's Fosse Verdon, but I can tell you that that show, which stars Sam Rockwell and Michelle Williams, is definitely going to be one that I'm looking forward to checking out. It's the story of Bod Fosse and Gwen Verdon, and so there's a lot of 50s, 60s, 70s cinematic and Broadway and musical references and dancing and choreography, and I'm not going to say anything more than I'm looking forward to seeing more episodes.
Daniel Feinberg is a TV critic for The Hollywood Reporter. He is also the president of the Television Critics Association. Daniel, thanks for your time and your insight.
Thank you for having me.
Coming up on The Frame, Annie Leibovitz walks through an exhibit of her early work. Think of any pop culture icon from the past 50 years, and they've probably been photographed by Annie Leibovitz. Although much of her background is in reportage, storytelling through photography, she's known best for her portraits and cover photos for Rolling Stone and Vanity Fair. She's photographed musicians, actors, poets, and politicians alike, from John Lennon to Meryl Streep to Richard Nixon. She was even spotted at a recent Beto O'Rourke rally. Now her early work is on display at Hauser & Wirth Gallery in the Arts District of downtown L.A. The show is called Annie Leibovitz, The Early Years, 1970 to 1983, Archive Project Number 1, and it chronicles her work at Rolling Stone magazine and her transformation from a photojournalist to a portrait photographer. I took a walk through the exhibition with Leibovitz last week, and we started with a 1970 anti-war demonstration where she'd taken pictures of Allen Ginsberg and Eldridge Cleaver. She was studying painting at the San Francisco Art Institute at the time, and I asked her how she went from paintbrushes to cameras.
I took a night class in photography and just found photography as a young person so much more, you know, gratifying and immediate, and it just felt right. And the people were a lot friendlier in the photo department than the painting. The painting was pretty abstract and pretty angry. You know, it was the Vietnam War, and the school was on the GI Bill, of course, and there were a lot of soldiers going to school, and a lot of drunk teachers, and it was a little scary for a 17, 18-year-old kid, and so the camera was very grounding.
Every novelist can probably remember the first piece of writing that he or she sold. Every actor can remember the first part that they got paid for. Is there an image in this room that you can remember being one of the first that you got paid for? And which one might it be?
Well, not paid much, that's for sure.
It doesn't matter, but actually, it was not
for
free.
Actually, Rolling Stone, the breakthrough moment was really this work that I did at this rally in San Francisco as anti-war rally. This one here, this actually was a cover of Rolling Stone.
Wow.
My first cover of Rolling Stone.
Well, I know where this is. This is the University of California, Berkeley.
That's right. That's right. What Rolling Stone was impressed with is this happened the day before. I went back to the school the day of the demonstration, processed the film, printed it, and brought it into Rolling Stone the next day. And they were so impressed that, because it was a very young magazine, it was a fold-up rag paper, and so they just started giving me work to do. And then I talked my way into going to New York with Jan Winter. He wanted to do an interview with John Lennon about the breakup of the Beatles. And they were really special, John and Yoko. They couldn't believe Jan Winter brought a kid to have their picture. And they were impressed with that, with Jan, I think. And they gave me carte blanche. It was really important because it would set the precedent for what I expected, how to be treated, you know, from then on out.
I think what a lot of people don't remember from that era is not just Rolling Stone, but Look and Life magazine were seriously committed to photography. They would commission photographers. They really embraced photography as a form of journalism, and they gave photographers a lot of leeway to do what they wanted to do. And you were really in the right place at the right time in many ways.
That was certainly some of the photography that I admired so much. Listen, I wanted to be a photojournalist, you know, when I started working for Rolling Stone. You know, I wanted to leave behind the fine art work. I was not a good photojournalist. So, you know, I was going to have to tell more of my story from my point of view, and left journalism behind and eventually turned to portraiture because it was a way of sort of having real license to do what you wanted in a photograph and not worry about crossing over to the other side.
When I look at these pictures, there is a candor to them that seems like a relic, that in some ways the way that celebrities or anybody controls his or her own image right now is so tightly choreographed.
Yeah, you can't.
And it feels like you were, I don't know if you just kind of embedded yourself so they forgot about you. How did you get this kind of access? Because the world was different, but also I have a feeling you had a way to make yourself disappear into their world.
You know, it really was a different time, and people were more open to just, you know, letting you be there. I mean, things are much more controlled now. You know, I'm trying to bring back the photo essay now, and it's really hard.
Because?
Just for that kind of thing. I did a cover story on Lena Waithe for Vanity Fair, and I just told her what I wanted to do, and she said, okay. But that's rare. I mean, I just kind of hung in her house while she worked and wrote and took a few pictures and went in and out. I mean, it's not like you're there for 24 hours, but you just go in and out of someone's life. I'm trying to incorporate some of that with people who will give us that. I just worked on a politician that I had that kind of access to.
That'd be Beto O'Rourke?
I can't say.
your poker face is terrible. I want to play a game against you. What is it about politicians that is unusual or interesting that maybe you don't find in celebrities?
Well, in my day, in the early work, they really had no idea about what it was like to be photographed, what it meant. Like, they were just kind of like, they had no idea what anything was. And it was kind of like a free-for-all. You could really just, I mean, here you're seeing the Nixon resignation. But, you know, it wasn't so locked up. You know, now, like any well-known person, it's hard to get this kind of access.
One of the things I love about some of these pictures, like the resignation of Nixon.
I shall resign the presidency effective at noon tomorrow.
My recollection is you took all these pictures, and I want to say it was Hunter S. Thompson who was supposed to file the copy, and he missed his deadline.
That's the story.
And so you just ran photos because there was no copy. He didn't make deadline.
He was at the Washington Hilton by the pool with a battery-powered television set.
And so we leave in good spirit and with deep humility.
And he never made it over there for Nixon going off, and Rolling Stone had held open like 8 to 12 pages waiting for his story to file, and they ended up taking my pictures and just blowing them up. So it was the first time Rolling Stone really used photography in a big way.
We're talking with Annie Leibovitz about her show, The Early Years, 1970 to 1983, Archive Project Number 1. How do you move from being a photojournalist to somebody who takes portraits? Is there a natural evolution? Is there something you learn in reportage that you can do in portraiture?
I think that's one of the sub-stories in this show is that you get to see that. You get to see this kind of sketching. I think when I said I became a portrait photographer, I think doing the covers in the magazine is sort of pinned you down to doing a moment with your subject, and I wanted them to be very good photographs, and they became good portraits, but they were totally fed by these pictures.
Well, let's talk about what we're looking at. We're looking at a wall of pictures that are taken during a Rolling Stones tour. Backstage, on stage, hotel rooms.
Well, let's put this in context. In 1972, Robert Frank was the tour. He did a film, *Cocker's Blues*, for the Rolling Stones. And you know, I went to two or three cities on that tour.
We're the two up here we have never done before.
Truman Capote was supposed to be writing something for Rolling Stone. Never.
He didn't make Deadline.
He didn't make Deadline. Right, exactly. So I went to two or three cities, and I got to watch Robert Frank work. So in 75, when Mick Jagger said, would you be the tour photographer, I was on board. I really wanted to do it. And, you know, I didn't know what I was walking into. It was still very naive. I took my tennis racket with me thinking I was going to... Anyway, but it was 27 cities. And again, I think the underlying story in this show or this work or this edit is what it means to be a young photographer and out there and taking pictures. Now, this, and you can see it in the earlier work, that I thought that if you just become part of what's going on, you can take the best pictures. And this almost killed me. You know, really, it was almost the death of me because I was really in over my head. And it took me a long time to get off the tour. People said, oh, how was the concert? I never heard the concert. I didn't hear the music. I was so concentrating on taking the picture so much, I never... You know, and then you're at the mercy of whoever's in the lighting and they're all on drugs and it's, you know, whatever.
I'm going to ask this last question. I was talking on the way over here about a novelist I know who said it's very hard for him to read something that he wrote even a year or two ago because he sees his mistakes and his development. Are you self-critical that way as well? Do you look back at early pictures and say, I should have done it differently? Or are you
God, early pictures, I mean, every day, you know. I was very lucky. I had Bea Feitler as an art director for a few years. And she had worked at Rolling Stone and at Ms. And she was, you know, this very famous art director from Harper's Bazaar. She told me early on that the way you are going to learn of what to do to go forward is you have to look back. And I took that pretty seriously. And I all along the way, I've worked on edits of my work and done books, you know, and stopped at some point. The first one was 1970, 1990, 20 years of work, and I went back and looked at the work, and I saw then this work, and I said, oh my gosh, this is really interesting, this reportage. You know, it's like I realized what I had sort of lost, you know, that I wasn't doing that anymore. You couldn't go back to it completely, but you could learn from it.
Annie, thanks so much for coming on the show.
It was great. Thank you very much.
The Annie Leibovitz exhibit is at the Hauser & Wirth Gallery through April 14th. Coming up on the frame, the venerable country swing band Asleep at the Wheel hits the half-century mark. Asleep at the Wheel has been making country western swing music for nearly 50 years. At this point, they've carried on a tradition which started in the 1930s, longer than the genre's creator, Bob Wills, the king of western swing.
Take me back to Tulsa, I'm too young to marry. Take me back to Tulsa.
Asleep at the Wheel founder Ray Benson and the band's fiddler and singer Katie Shore visited the frame recently to talk about the band's latest album. It's called New Roots. It features originals written by both Shore and Benson, as well as a few cover songs by Guy Clark and Johnny Cash. Unifying it all is a love for the foundations of American music.
My name's Katie Shore, and I'm the female vocalist and fiddle player for Asleep at the Wheel.
And I'm Ray Benson, and I've led this band for 48 years, down some strange paths.
Now I'm a feller with a heart of gold and the ways of a gentleman, I've been told.
It was 1969, and I was in college and was going to be a film director, and then decided to play music. I've always played music since I was a child performer. I played folk music, rock and roll, jazz, but anything, whatever. And I said, I want to start a American roots band that plays the music that it seems to be forgotten.
Smoke, smoke, smoke that cigarette.
And if you puff yourself to death. 30s, 40s was our inspiration. On the western side, Bob Wills and the Texas Playboys, and many others, Moon Mullican. And then what Saved Wheels morphed into over the years has been a fiddle-based swing band. Here is one of the fiddlers and one of the and mouth trumpet players.
That's right.
I'm so high and so dry. I'm sailing.
Yes, my first fiddle contest was probably when I was 7 years old. And growing up in Texas, my granddad played the fiddle and used to play for us at home, and I really loved it. And so there was a fiddle community in Fort Worth, and the contest scene was a part of it. I won one in Seguin.
What'd you play one that time. First one?
Probably Boil the Cabbage Down.
Let's see if we can't get those fiddles one more time.
Her brother plays fiddle, too, so it was just you and your brother both play fiddle?
Yep, the two of us. And I started a little before him, but our fiddle playing is rooted in those tunes more than anything. You learn Red Wing, you learn Milk Cow Blues, you know, starting off on the fiddle. There's a lot of the crossover from the Western swing that ends up in those, you know, tunes that you learn for the fiddle contest as well.
It's your friendly king of Western swing, and time to ride that transcribed musical trail with Bob Wills and the Texas Playboys. And here are the Texas Playboys on the Lone Star Rag.
You know, it's a funny story that I've told. It's not funny, but I met Bob Wills. We went up to Dallas to meet him. He was making a record called For the Last Time. He was in a wheelchair, and we walked in the studio, and they said, Mr. Wills is asleep at the wheel. And he was really, really ill. They said, he's very tired, we're taking him back to his motel and you can talk to him tomorrow. And they took him to his motel, and he had a stroke and went to a coma. And 2 years later, we were playing the Longhorn Ballroom, which was the Bob Wills Ranch House in Dallas, and he died that day. All I care about for Asleep at the Wheel is that what we put on the on a record is good material done well.
Well, I wish I was in Austin. At the chilly part of bar, drinking Mad Dog margaritas and not caring where you are.
I liked this music when I was 19, and it wasn't what was cool. I just think there's always a segment of the population that is attracted to different than mainstream music, and this we're certainly a unique band.
It's true. I think the grooves, I think the music, and, you know, even though we're, this record is a little bit of an evolution of some of that, you know, a little more eclectic as far as roots go. But I think that not only does the music speak for itself, but I think their band is younger these days. And I think that people our age that see us up there really taking it seriously. And I think that just having good energy is what's attractive maybe the most. And this music is fun and lighthearted.
She just turned 30. When I started the band in 1970, started recruiting players, I could not find a fiddle player of my age. Now I am the luckiest guy because I get to find fine fiddle players. When I was looking for the singer, I had a little club in Austin, and I was looking on YouTube because we sometimes would post what was on the stage.
It's 2 a.m. and I'm back again in this sleepy town.
She had she got a gig there. Didn't pay much, did it?
Didn't pay much. I'm not sure I made any money after I paid the two guys.
And I saw it. I went, who is this girl? Because there's a quality to her voice that is in between, you know, Billie Holiday and a Western swing singer in her voice. And then she picked up the fiddle, and I was like, oh gosh, she plays fiddle too.
I grew up listening to Asleep at the Wheel, and that was one of the things what I laugh. My mom told me when I was a kid, I wanted to play the kind of music you clap your hands and stomp your feet to.
You know, this is music that was developed in the 30s, refined and changed through the years, but is still alive right now.
People will still get up and dance in the aisles, which we love so much. It's hard to sit still to this music.
I got 7 nights to rock. I got 7 nights to roll. 7 nights I'm gonna show my face with a different chicken in a different place.
And that is it for today. Remember to follow us on Twitter and Facebook. You can find us at The Frame. I'm John Horn. Thanks for listening. We'll see you back here tomorrow.
At the old dance hall, Wednesday, at the Roadhouse Inn, Thursday, at the Lion's Den, Friday, at the Chatterbox, Saturday, Sunday, everybody rocks. 7 nights to rock. I got 7 nights to roll. 7 nights to roll.